You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, there's a reason FDR became FDR, and it's because the people wanted him to. He didn't run on the platform of the New Deal. He ran on a platform of basically slow and steady. Not what the people wanted, though, and when he took office, that's, you know, the people got what they wanted. Is that happening again? Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on. I want to continue my riff on yesterday's Supreme Court decision, too. But the president gave a speech this morning that was just astounding. And, you know, I suppose the cynics will say, oh, yeah, this is round one of the election campaign. That's fine with me. I don't care why he's saying the things that need to be said. And frankly, I think the why has, you know, a lot to do with trying to get elected or reelected president. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that finally the Republicans have overreached. Well, not finally. I mean, you know, now it's just like it has become so obvious. It has become so vivid. It has become so disgusting, so amazing. First of all, the president, well, not necessarily first of all, but where I want to start, the president pointed out, you know, you got all these guys running around with their hair on fire of, oh, it's the budget deficit. We're spending too much money. We've got to do something. We're spending too much money? Don't you guys all worship at the shrine of Ronald Reagan? Play this clip, Jacob.
So in the months ahead, I will be fighting as hard as I know how for this truer vision of what the United States of America is all about. Absolutely, we have to get serious about the deficit. And that will require tough choices and sacrifice. And I've already shown myself willing to make these tough choices when I signed into law the biggest spending cut of any president in recent memory. In fact, if you adjust for the economy, the Congressional Budget Office says the overall spending next year will be lower than any year under Ronald Reagan.
Lower than any year under Ronald Reagan. Every conservative in America has to be standing up and saluting right now, right? All the Republicans, they have to be crowding into the in front of the cameras, in front of the Capitol building to say, "We're with you, Barack Obama, President Obama. You're spending less than even Ronald Reagan. Holy cow, this is incredible." I mean, whether it's in inflation-adjusted dollars or real dollars, in either case, this is a big deal. Spend less than Reagan. But that's not good enough for the Republicans. Even though our government spends half of what the Canadian government does as a percentage of GDP, less than half of what virtually every other developed country in the world does, because we don't pay for free college education for all of our kids and we don't pay for health care for all of our people. Instead, we let for-profit agencies provide that. In fact, in Republic Report this morning, I thought I'd printed it out, but it's not here. Anyway, in the Republic Report this morning, there's this whole thing about how kids who go to for-profit schools and even adults, more likely to fail, more likely to be in debt. Gee, I wonder what that has to do with it. Well, it has to do with the fact that they're in business to make money. But, okay, tangential rant. Back to Obama. Clip number 8, Jacob. Here is the president saying, if you guys pass, now, it ain't going to happen unless in the 2012 election the Republicans take control of the House and the White House. Or maybe even if they just take, or excuse me, the Senate. Maybe if they just get control of the Senate and they've got enough votes to override a presidential veto. But it did. The Paul Ryan budget did pass the House of Representatives with every single Republican except 10 voting for it. No Democrat voted for it, but all the Republicans except 10 voted for the Paul Ryan budget. And the president very neatly, very elegantly, very succinctly, in a minute and 39 seconds, lays out what the consequences of that would be.
The year after next, nearly 10 million college students would see their financial aid cut by an average of more than $1,000 each. There would be 1,600 fewer medical grants, research grants for things like Alzheimer's and cancer and AIDS. There would be 4,000 fewer scientific research grants, eliminating support for 48,000 researchers, students, and teachers. Investments in clean energy technologies that are helping us reduce our dependence on foreign oil would be cut by nearly a fifth. If this budget becomes law and the cuts were applied evenly, starting in 2014, over 200,000 children would lose their chance to get an early education in the Head Start program. 2 million mothers and young children would be cut from a program that gives them access to healthy food. There would be 4,500 fewer federal grants at the Department of Justice and the FBI to combat violent crime, financial crime, and help secure our borders. Hundreds of national parks would be forced to close for part or all of the year. We wouldn't have the capacity to enforce the laws that protect the air we breathe, the water we drink, or the food that we eat. Cuts to the FAA would likely result in more flight cancellations, delays, and the complete elimination of air traffic control services in parts of the country. Over time, our weather forecasts would become less accurate because we wouldn't be able to afford to launch new satellites. And that means governors and mayors would have to wait longer to order evacuations in the event of a hurricane. That's just a partial sampling of the consequences of this budget. This is not conjecture. I am not exaggerating. These are facts.
Yeah, facts are stubborn things, as I believe it was Ronald Reagan famously said. And here are the facts. Those are the facts of what would happen if the Paul Ryan budget was passed, as President Obama, clip number nine, points out. It actually goes even further than that.
If this budget became law by the middle of the century, funding for the kinds of things I just mentioned would have to be cut by about 95%. Let me repeat that. Those categories I just mentioned, we would have to cut by 95%.
And then he just basically comes right out and says what this is. And, here it is, clip 10.
This congressional Republican budget is something different altogether. It is a Trojan horse. Disguised as deficit reduction plans, it is really an attempt to impose a radical vision on our country. It is thinly veiled social Darwinism. It is antithetical to our entire history as a land of opportunity and upward mobility for everybody who's willing to work for it. And by gutting the very things we need to grow an economy that's built to last, education and training, research and development, our infrastructure, it is a prescription for decline.
Exactly, a prescription for decline. This is extraordinary. And the Paul Ryan voucher plan for Medicaid. I don't get how the Republicans think they're going to run on this, but they're all out there defending it. Here's the president describing what's going to happen to Medicare. Now, granted, most people in the United States are not approaching 65 or at or above, and so this is like not a huge deal for them. Actually, this is a minute and 10, and we only have a minute to the break, so I'll have to come back to this clip. But clip number five, Jacob. This is just a great little summary. Here you go.
Instead of moderating their views even slightly, the Republicans running Congress right now have doubled down and proposed a budget so far to the right, it makes the contract with America look like the New Deal.
Yeah, and it makes Ronald Reagan look like a liberal. This is not the Republican budget is not a budget to move America forward. The Republican budget is a budget to take America back to the age of the robber barons, when you had a very small number of very rich people, a very, very small middle class, and the vast majority of Americans, well over 90% of Americans, lived in poverty. Or they lived as, on small family farms where they basically ate the food that they grew. And that was it. And, by the way, we don't have those small family farms anymore, so, start growing a garden. Because that's the Paul Ryan plan for you. We have two clear visions for America now. Are we going to build this country and move it forward? Or are we going to take it back to 1880? Your choice. Register to vote. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll hear from the president about this so-called voucher plan. And your thoughts on his talk this morning. If you caught it, I'd love to hear what you think. How do you think the Republicans are going to successfully get away with trying to promote the Paul Ryan budget. Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan traveling around Wisconsin over the last 4 days, stuck together like glue. There's talk about Paul Ryan as Mitt Romney's running mate because he's a guy who can bring along the Midwestern vote. He's the guy who can bring along the hard right vote. He's the guy who, most importantly, can bring along the Koch brothers, can bring along the big billionaires who are willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to secure the White House for the hard right. How are these guys going to successfully run on this? The only way that I can think of is that they're going to demonize the president in ways that are untrue and unfair. They're going to swift boat him. And it'll all be under the radar. It's not going to be, you know, you'll recall the George W. Bush campaign did not come out and say, oh, well, we think that John Kerry should give back those Purple Hearts. They never said a word. In fact, repeatedly, they were asked to say a word, and they didn't say a word, which was the same thing as saying, oh, yeah, there might be something to that. And now with Citizens United, you don't even need, I mean, you know, back then it was Jerry Corsi running around doing his, Jerome Corsi doing his wackadoodle stuff and doing talk radio shows and Fox News promoting it very heavily and a lot of viral emails. Now it's going to be, you know, $100 million advertising campaign on television brought to you by groups that you never heard of, you know, Americans for a Better Government Tomorrow, today, now, maybe. Right? Something like that, not to borrow a title from Stephen Colbert. Because the president is coming out and saying, you know, middle class, 99%, all of you who vote, I'm with you. And Paul Ryan is coming out and saying that he wants to screw the middle class. He wants to destroy the middle class. He wants to give a $3 trillion tax break to billionaires. And this is not like fuzzy lines. This is a clear line in the sand. How can the Republicans possibly push through this? Maybe Mitt Romney's going to reinvent himself as a moderate, and he's going to run as Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, he's flip-flopped on everything else. The conservatives are now saying, oh, okay, we'll take his latest flip-flop. No problem. But the president pointed out that we've got some real, genuine, serious structural problems. Clip number one here, Jacob. This is how inequality is destroying the United States. It is bringing us down. The last time I heard a president talking about inequality was Lyndon Johnson. I'm not sure Jimmy Carter ever even talked about inequality. It certainly didn't come along during the Reagan administration. It didn't come along during the first Bush administration. Things were rip-roaring. The economy was white hot with Bill Clinton. I don't think he needed to talk about it. It certainly didn't happen during the last Bush administration. Certainly it was a big theme for Franklin Roosevelt. And it's possible that Lyndon Johnson didn't even talk about inequality. He just talked about poverty. But in any case, here's President Obama on inequality.
It doesn't make us weaker when we guarantee basic security for the elderly or the sick or those who are actively looking for work. What makes us weaker is when fewer and fewer people can afford to buy the goods and services our businesses sell, or when entrepreneurs don't have the financial security to take a chance and start a new business. What drags down our entire economy is when there is an ever-widening chasm between the ultra-rich and everybody else.
An ever-widening chasm between the ultra-rich and everybody else. And he's talking about people, you know, without health care for everybody. There's a lot of people who are stuck in dead-end jobs that would love to get rid of those jobs, love to go off on their own. They got a business idea. They got something they want to try out. Can't do it. Can't afford the $12,000, $15,000 a year for a family that it would cost for health insurance. And, you know, even worse, what if they got sick and that, you know, that cobra might only last a while? In fact, Obama goes right after, this is clip number two, he goes right after the heart of Reaganomics, which has been the economic policy of this country from 1981 until today, because, you know, the Republicans still control the House of Representatives, and the Democrats, they say, well, the Democrats controlled the Senate there for a while. Not really. Not with Ben Nelson and Blanche Lincoln. Not really. And actually, not even legally, not even technically, because you had Joe Lieberman in there, who was not a Democrat. But in any case, here's the president calling out trickle-down economics.
In this country, broad-based prosperity has never trickled down from the success of a wealthy few. It has always come from the success of a strong and growing middle class. That's how a generation who went to college on the GI Bill, including my grandfather, helped build the most prosperous economy the world has ever known.
This man's starting to sound like Franklin Roosevelt. Clip number three, we tried trickle-down economics.
We're told that when the wealthy become even wealthier and corporations are allowed to maximize their profits by whatever means necessary, it's good for America, and that their success will automatically translate into more jobs and prosperity for everybody else. That's the theory. Now, the problem for advocates of this theory is that we've tried their approach on a massive scale. The results of their experiment are there for all to see.
Yeah, 30 years of disaster, 30 years of a wiped-out middle class, 30 years of the rich getting mind-bogglingly richer. Since Reaganomics was put into place, the rich have seen their income go up over 270%. The rest of us, the other 99%, not so much. In fact, the bottom quintiles has even fallen. The middle class has flattened out. It's pretty much kind of gone. This concept, this bizarre notion, you know, the Lafler curve, you know, okay, we need to get taxes right in this sweet spot here, and trickle-down economics, yeah, if you got a bunch of people building, you know, multi-million dollar mansions, then, you know, hey, it puts people to work. Well, yeah, sort of, but what happened to building the middle class? What happened to a trade policy that actually puts America first? What happened to the Buy America Act that was passed in 1935 and is still a law? What happened to the Sherman Antitrust Act passed in 1881 and is still a law? Reagan has stopped enforcement of it. I mean, both of them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Bottom line, it all began with Reagan, and this is the first president since Ronald Reagan willing to come out and say it in as many words. So the question, you know, the question that I'm asking is the question I suppose the president is implying in clip number six here, Jacob. You know, how is Mitt Romney going to run on a budget that destroys basically all of America, all of the core American infrastructure, everything from public education to public works to our air traffic system to, you know, basically everything. 95% of it, you know, as the president pointed out. And this is just, as he said, it's just the math. How is Romney going to run on this?
One of my potential opponents, Governor Romney, has said that he hoped a similar version of this plan from last year would be introduced as a bill on day one of his presidency. He said that he's very supportive of this new budget, and he even called it marvelous, which is a word you don't often hear when it comes to describing a budget. It's a word you don't often hear generally.
Yeah, Mitt Romney is fond of anachronisms, but wait until they unzip him. He'll get much more enthusiastic. But in any case, so Mitt Romney is like married here to Paul Ryan into this budget, and the president just, you know, stuck them together like glue. Here he is explaining the voucher program, clip 11, Jacob.
Instead of being enrolled in Medicare when they turn 65, seniors who retire a decade from now would get a voucher that equals the cost of the second cheapest health care plan in their area. If Medicare is more expensive than that private plan, they'll have to pay more if they want to enroll in traditional Medicare. If health care costs rise faster than the amount of the voucher, as, by the way, they've been doing for decades, that's too bad. Seniors bear the risk. If the voucher isn't enough to buy a private plan with the specific doctors and care that you need, that's too bad. So most experts will tell you the way this voucher plan encourages savings is not through better care at cheaper cost. The way these private insurance companies save money is by designing and marketing plans to attract the youngest and healthiest seniors, cherry picking, leaving the older and sicker seniors in traditional Medicare, where they have access to a wide range of doctors and guaranteed care. But that, of course, makes the traditional Medicare program even more expensive and raise premiums even further. The net result is that our country will end up spending more on health care. And the only reason the government will save any money, it won't be on our books, is because we've shifted it to seniors. It's a bad idea. And it will ultimately end Medicare as we know it.
And ultimately end Medicare as we know it. So anyhow, I've got some more to share with you. We'll do it through the program. Your thoughts on this. I think I've made mine clear. Dustin in St. Louis. Hey, Dustin, what's up?
Hey, love the show. What a program. Just want to comment on the debt hysteria from the conservatives. You know, I always like to point out to people that we don't really have a debt crisis in this country. We're awash with money. What we have is a revenue crisis due to regressive taxation. I think the perfect historical illustration of that is you compare the Vietnam War to that of the Iraq-Afghan wars. Wars that both cost a tremendous lot. But however, the Afghan-Iraq wars cost us trillions of dollars to where we maintain a relatively balanced budget throughout the Vietnam War, the difference being the taxation system. At that time, the wealthy paid their due, as well as corporations.
Yeah, that was a large piece of it, Dustin. The other part of it was that with Iraq and Afghanistan, more than half of the heavy lifting is being done by private contractors who are making, you know, $150,000 each, and their cost to us is $250,000, whereas, you know, the other half is being done by GIs who are making, you know, squat. And so it's become a giant profitable honeypot for honeypot, I guess, is the wrong phrase. That refers to something else. But, you know, you understand the point for the defense contractors. Yeah. Dustin, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. John in Santa Cruz. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. To stay with what he was talking about with taxes, is I think I've actually come up with a plan for once in my life that's other than breaking something. So just give me 30 seconds here. Tom, if we recognize that all wealth creation taxes the environment at some level, whether it's financial environments that people live inside of or whatever level, if you're clear-cutting, you should certainly be more taxed heavily than someone who's going into the forest and practicing sustainable removal of trees.
Sure.
And someone who's line fishing should certainly have lower taxes than someone who has a boat that's only allowed to go out 3 weeks a year. Because,
well, when we lived in Vermont, we actually had some forest land, and yeah, we had a guy come in with horses and selectively cut some of the lumber out of it, and it actually, I mean, it made more money than it cost us, a couple $1,000, but that wasn't why we did it. We did it to make the forest healthier because the forests in America are not natural forests. They had all been clear cut at one point, and then you get these kind of monogrowths back up.
Living in one.
Yeah.
I have 26 redwoods around me, and I would have had about 5.
Yeah. So you know what I'm talking about.
Just real quickly, I believe.
But in any case, the point that I was making is that the state of Vermont, we actually paid a lower property tax because we were maintaining that forest than we would have had we simply cut the whole thing and sold the wood.
I'm so happy to hear that. I mean, really, but I believe the whole tax system can be shifted that way.
Yeah.
Because I believe that companies would turn into the most sustainable. Wealthy companies would spend lots and lots of money on R&D to try to find out how they could impact the environment just a little bit less if their taxes were tied to the environment.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you at all, John. Good point. Thanks a lot for the call. Gary in Perryopolis, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, that's it.
I've never heard of that town. That's great. Perryopolis, what a cool name. Gary, what's up?
I'm calling about Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And I get, like, really emotional because I'm on Medicare right now.
Right.
And I use that when I go to the hospital and doctors, and I also go to the VA medical.
Mm-hmm.
And I get really upset when all these guys talk about what they're going to do to Medicare. Same was with Social Security last year or this year when they weren't going to save it or whatever, you know?
Yeah,
really,
well, George Bush was.
I'm on Social Security.
Yeah, George Bush was trying to privatize it in 2005. That's what he was going to use the political capital he got from declaring a war against Saddam Hussein to you know, and he tried in 2005 after the election. He tried to privatize Social Security and all that money off to Wall Street. They didn't, you know, Congress wouldn't go along with him. Even his own Republicans, some of them wouldn't go along with him.
Yeah, I'm a Navy veteran of 14 years, and I mean, I understand all that war stuff. You know, not that I agree with it. I got out after Desert Storm, but
yeah.
Anyways, I'm just like I said, I'm real emotional about all this trash that they're talking about. They're going to cut Medicaid and all this, or Medicare. You know, it's just, like I said, it just really upsets me. And I don't think these guys know how emotional and personal it is to me.
Well, here's the thing, Gary. I'm on all these email lists for right wingers as well as left wingers, and I have gotten in the last couple of months probably, I don't know, several hundred emails that talk about how President Obama wants to end Medicare as we know it. How President Obama cut a half. In fact, Mitt Romney repeated this lie just the other day. He said, President Obama with Obamacare cuts $500 million or $500 trillion, $500 billion out of Medicare. It actually doesn't cut anything out of Medicare. What it does is it cuts it out of Medicare Advantage, which is the for-profit piece, and moves it into Medicare where it can be done more economically. So it's not going to cost seniors anything. But, as Mark Twain famously said, a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth has even got its boots on. And that's what they're going to be doing. They're going to be saying, they're going to be blaming, and you mark my words, they're going to be blaming the president for exactly what they are trying to do, which is destroy Medicare and privatize Social Security. Gary, thank you for the call. I wish you well. You know, keep fighting on this thing. And, we'll see where it goes. Joe in Toledo, Ohio, listening to WDTW. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi. I think we're giving the Supreme Court cover because I think they're going to rule in favor of Obamacare.
I do, too.
They're going to point to that. Yes, I do. And they're going to point to that and say, you can forget about all those other conservative things we did. See, we're actually liberal because this is what you're asking for.
Yeah, I think this is John Roberts worried about his legacy as well.
Yeah, but I think we should take note that 5 years ago, the Heritage Institute was asking for essentially Obamacare.
Yes.
And we've sort of been positioned around, we've been manipulated into arguing their position now.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree. And it's unfortunate that it was the best bad option that you could get past the United States Senate, which, had so many conservadems, the Ben Nelsons, the Mary Landrews, the Blanche Lincolns of the world in it. And Joe Lieberman and whatnot, that was just the best that they could do. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, minute to the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Sounds like you're falling in love with candidate Obama, the progressive liberal, who unfortunately is going to turn into President Obama, the neocon, after he's elected.
What I'm saying, Ed, is that any president, and I started the show by pointing out that Franklin Roosevelt ran on a platform of being the neocon, moderate, whatever you want to call it, and he became a progressive, that any president responds to the wind behind his back, to the power of the people, and that the people are waking up. First of all, there's been enough pain inflicted by the Bush Great Recession that the people are waking up. And secondly, I think the people are starting to look out there and see with some clarity outside of Fox News. It was amazing this morning. I was over at the RT studios. We were, putting the show together. And here they've got these, three TV monitors, right? CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC on the wall. And on CNN and MSNBC, they were showing the president. And on Fox News, they were having a discussion. Megyn Kelly was discussing government spending too much. Right? I took a photo of it. It's amazing. So, that's what's going on. But in any case, my point about the president is, no, I'm not falling in love. I am acknowledging the political reality that if he gets enough pressure, he will move in the direction we want him to move.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
As will any politician, and it looks like that, that's the direction he's going. I mean, he has staked out this ground. He's going to have to stand there now. We do win the water cooler wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rose in Port Angeles, Washington, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Rose, what's up?
Hi. Well, I was just reading the Constitution the other day, and it says right there that it's to promote the general welfare.
It says it
and
twice.
I realized, yeah, right. So since when do people under 65 not qualify as the general welfare? I think everyone under 65 should demand to rescind the Medicare. And that way, all the Medicare people will be a riot, and there you go. Yeah, if you're going to do it, you don't get to discriminate against age anymore. Medicare for all, right there.
There you go. Drop the eligibility age to Medicare to zero. I'm totally with you, Rose.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Discriminating. Since when do we get to discriminate? retirement. He says general welfare. You're part of the welfare. I'm 55. I can't afford health insurance.
Yep. Okay. Hello? You're right. I totally agree with you. Thank you for the call. Well said. And in fact, let me add to that there's a whole bunch of things that are pieces of the general welfare, not just Medicare Part E and Social Security, for example. I don't think most 25-year-olds realize that a 25-year-old in the United States right now has $1.5 million insurance policy. It's called Social Security. If you fall and break your neck or injure yourself on the job and you become wheelchair-bound or housebound or disabled and you're 20 years old, 25 years old, 10 years old, 60 years old, 30 years, any age, Social Security, fully a third of all the payments from Social Security are for the Social Security disability. Social Security will cover your costs until the day you die. Everybody in America has this incredible insurance plan called Social Security Insurance. Harold in Shell Knob, Missouri. Hey, Harold, what's up?
Yeah, I just got off the phone with the White House. And one of the things that I told the person who answered the phone, that the first thing is that President Obama should get on the TV and tell him, I repudiate Obamacare. I don't repudiate just the care, but calling Obamacare, it ain't my care bill. It was written by the insurance companies.
Yeah.
Benefit the insurance companies.
Okay, we can call it insurance company care. Harold, thanks a lot for the call. I'm sorry your phone is not all that great. George in Forestville, Missouri. Hey, George, what's up?
Oh, Tom. We talk about Social Security being taken over by Goldman Sachs or whatever bank you want to call it,
yeah,
and privatizing it. But as of March of next year, there's a bank called Commercia, which I've never heard of before, and I'm on Social Security, is going to take over the however much money Social Security has and then deal it out to the people with debit cards or put it in their bank, whichever the case, whichever you choose. And that, I don't understand it. The bank,
right.
This bank.
What you're describing, George, is not a takeover of Social Security. What you're describing, and I've never heard of this bank, Commercia, but I'm guessing that what you're describing, because they've already done this with food stamps and other programs,
right.
Many other welfare programs, is the government right now, when they cut a check and they mail it to you every month, it costs them 40, 50 cents to produce that check, produce the envelope, mail that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a cost associated with that.
Right.
And so it is, and there's a certain amount of insecurity associated with that. You've got to get the thing from your mail, and your mail
right.
can get robbed. Then you've got to go to the bank and deposit it, and you can get robbed, and,
right.
you know, all those kind of things. So what they're going to do, I don't know if this is going to happen for Social Security, but what they have done for many of the government benefit programs, many states do this for unemployment, is they contract with a bank, and you've got to do it through a bank. I mean, in North Dakota, they can do it through their state bank. Every state should have their own bank, but we don't have a federal bank. So they have to use a commercial bank. And so what they do is they contract with a bank, and they say, we're going to send people basically a debit card, and we will put the money in that account, and then they can just go swipe that card. And it's a one-time postal fee instead of every month and or every couple
okay.
weeks. Ideally it works to the benefit of the government, and the banks make some money on it. Now, frankly, I think the banks make too much money on it, and I think at the end of the day, you know, I think it's a program that should be entirely federalized, or, the individual states should be able to start banks that can be run through it. But that's
right.
what they're describing. It's not a takeover of Social Security. It's just
a different
way of delivering a check to you, that's all.
I see. But at the same time now, remember this. These debit cards, when you go to a bank to use it, and you supposedly can go to any bank to use it, these banks charge a fee to use that card.
I know.
You know, and therefore, every bank in America, well, they're be making money off.
Everybody's going to be getting the
Social Security.
That's right. Now, on the other hand, if you try to cash a check, you know that your bank is going to charge you.
I understand.
Charge
but,
you a fee.
Okay, for instance, this one bank that I went to, they only let you take out a certain amount of money. You have to do five transactions, and each transaction they charge you $2 for it. So they end up getting $10 in their bank to give money.
To give you $300 on an ATM.
Yeah,
yeah, but that means that's not your bank. And again, this is the things that you're describing,
right.
George, are all really, really strong reasons why every state should do what North Dakota has done and create its own bank. And if not, then why you should be banking with a credit union. And, right. But you know, you've identified a concern, but it's, this is not, and thank you for the call, George. Let me just make it very clear. This is not the takeover of America. They want to, but this is not it. Linda in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Linda, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hi, I just saw the movie Heist here at our Cleveland Film Festival, which you had narrated.
Mm-hmm.
And in the movie, you referred to the Mandate for Leadership publication that was put out with the Heritage Foundation, which I actually was able to get from our library.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1,100 pages long. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what this book does and how we are living it today.
Well, this was the kind of original vision. I have not read the 1,100 pages, but so and I don't think you have either.
Neither have I.
But my understanding is that this was basically the Powell memo converted into policy. This was the vision of what America could or should become if we became basically the society that is not unlike that Charles Dickens lived in and wrote about. And
yeah, it's the Republican Bible.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
How do we overcome this?
Well, we call it out, which the president did today, and brilliantly. And more of us need to be doing it. And you know,
I encourage everyone to find that movie, Heist.
Yeah, heist-themovie.org, I believe, is the website. Thank you very much, Linda. I'm totally with you. And I was honored to narrate that movie. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. As advertised, the president has come out and spoken out about the Ryan budget plan. I want to get Peter Ferrara on here in about a minute and have him explain the conservative perspective on this. But first, just to set the stage, here is what the president had to say would be the consequence of Paul Ryan's budget.
The year after next, nearly 10 million college students would see their financial aid cut by an average of more than $1,000 each. There would be 1,600 fewer medical grants, research grants for things like Alzheimer's and cancer and AIDS. There would be 4,000 fewer scientific research grants, eliminating support for 48,000 researchers, students, and teachers. Investments in clean energy technologies that are helping us reduce our dependence on foreign oil would be cut by nearly a fifth. If this budget becomes law and the cuts were applied evenly, starting in 2014, over 200,000 children would lose their chance to get an early education in the Head Start program. 2 million mothers and young children would be cut from a program that gives them access to healthy food. There would be 4,500 fewer federal grants at the Department of Justice and the FBI to combat violent crime, financial crime, and help secure our borders. Hundreds of national parks would be forced to close for part or all of the year. We wouldn't have the capacity to enforce the laws that protect the air we breathe, the water we drink, or the food that we eat. Cuts to the FAA would likely result in more flight cancellations, delays, and the complete elimination of air traffic control services in parts of the country. Over time, our weather forecasts would become less accurate because we wouldn't be able to afford to launch new satellites. And that means governors and mayors would have to wait longer to order evacuations in the event of a hurricane. That's just a partial sampling of the consequences of this budget. This is not conjecture. I am not exaggerating. These are facts.
Yeah, pretty straightforward stuff. Peter Ferrara is with us. He is a senior fellow at the Carlson Center for Public Policy. TheCCPP.org is the website, and the author of America's Ticking Bankruptcy Bomb, the book. And Peter, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Paul Ryan has responded to what you just heard the president say, and Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney are campaigning together in Wisconsin. Have been stuck together like glue for the last 4 days. And Paul Ryan did not dispute anything that the president just said about the Paul Ryan budget. How can you guys imagine that you could win in America by saying that you're going to do those things that the president just described?
That's just a Washington Monument ploy. Paul Ryan's budget just returns federal taxes and spending to their long-term historical post-war averages over the last 7 years. You turn federal spending to the 20% of GDP, whereas under the budget proposed by President Obama and supported by the Democrats, federal spending is worse to 30% of GDP by 2027, 40% by 2040, 50% by 2060, and 80% by 2080. So the question before the American people is, do you want to restore federal taxes and spending to the same level of GDP as existed for 70 years after World War II, under which America became the most prosperous and mightiest power in the history of the world, or do you want to massively increase government spending, ultimately to 80% of GDP?
So do we want to take us back to the era of Dwight Eisenhower when millionaires and billionaires paid 91% income tax, when 35% of total federal revenues were coming from corporations instead of the 11% right now, when the top 400 people did not own an amount of wealth greater than that of the bottom 150 million. And in fact, here's what the president had to say about the budget that he submitted that you just said would end up with 80% of the federal, the GDP being federal spending. Here's what the president had to say.
And I've already shown myself willing to make these tough choices when I signed into law the biggest spending cut of any president in recent memory. In fact, if you adjust for the economy, the Congressional Budget Office says the overall spending next year will be lower than any year under Ronald Reagan.
And once again, Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney do not dispute that.
Yeah, that sounds like he needs to report to a mental hospital because that's CBO was completely factually incorrect, according to CBO.
The numbers he's quoting the Congressional Budget Office.
Well, the numbers I gave you from the Congressional Budget Office and also in Ryan's budget, the path to prosperity, under the budget proposed by President Obama and the Democrats, federal spending soars to 30% of GDP by 2027, 40%.
That's nonsense, Peter. That's absolute nonsense. No, not even his own party would support any kind of numbers like that. What you guys are doing is you're cherry-picking numbers out and then exaggerating them wildly, first of all. Secondly, there is no way that this thing is a path to prosperity that Paul Ryan is proposing. What I hear you doing is trying to put lipstick on a pig. I have not heard you dispute any of the things that the president said.
My statement is not an issue over which reason people can differ. It's in the Congressional Budget Office. And if you look it up in Ryan's budget, it's published directly from the Congressional Budget Office. And I'll also leave you with this. Ryan's Medicare is better for seniors than Obamacare's Medicare.
It's better to get a voucher.
That's why it's going to be
where you have to take it to a private health insurance company whose CEO is making $1 billion. That's going to be better for you.
Well, let me explain what it is. Obamacare cut Medicare payments to doctors and hospitals by $500 billion.
No, not true. That's a lie, Peter.
Well, that's
you are quoting a lie that Mitt Romney told, and it's a lie.
Not a statement.
The $500 billion is not from Medicare. It's from Medicare Advantage. It is the money that has been siphoned off to private corporations and is being in large part paid by seniors to Medicare Advantage. And what President Obama said is, no, we the people, the government is going to cover this. We got it under control, and we're going to cut the costs.
Well, I understand that you have to make a fact to justify your position, and that is what you do all day long. But what you just said is so egregious that I need an apology to your audience right now because it's an abuse of the First Amendment.
I am saying that you are quoting Mitt Romney telling a lie. I stand behind that.
I don't even know what Mitt Romney said about it.
Mitt Romney said that the president that Obamacare will cut a half a trillion, $500 billion out of Medicare, and it simply is not factual. And then you just recited that, and it is not factual.
This is not a statement over which reasonable people can differ. Obamacare cut Medicare payments to doctors and hospitals by $500 billion in the first 6 years alone. And it adds up to trillions of dollars over the long run.
Not true.
In the Obama administration's own reports, the Treasury Department issues a report, the financial statement of the United States government, and it added up to trillions of dollars in cuts over the long run.
So it sounds to me, Peter, that the strategy, my original question to you is, how can you guys think that you're going to have electoral victories by running on Paul Ryan's budget that basically slashes government down to nothing? And it sounds to me like the answer is that you're going to obfuscate or you're going to misrepresent what the president himself is doing and try to suggest that what the president is doing, on the one hand, is either taking us to 80% of all spending is the government. In other words, we become, Sweden on steroids, a socialist paradise. Or, on the other hand, the president is trying to slash Medicare to the point where seniors can't even get health care, which seems a little schizophrenic to me. Not to suggest that you're schizophrenic, just the logic.
All Paul Ryan's budget does is return America to the long-term post-war historical federal spending as a percent of GDP.
That's nonsense. Peter, who says a percentage of GDP should be any kind of criteria for anything. What, do you want to take us back to where we were in 1800 when it was like 1% or 3% of GDP?
You're not making any sense. I mean, you said the Biden budget cuts it down to nothing, and I explained to you it's the same level as existed for 70 years after World War II. So I proved you wrong. It's not a statement over which reasonable people can differ. Please take it back and apologize.
No, I will not, because what the Biden budget is going to do is it's going to devastate the American middle class, or it's going to lead to massive budget deficits because it's not being paid for. You want to talk about historic budgets. Historically, millionaires and billionaires were taxed at 74 to 91%. Right now, Mitt Romney's paying 14.5%. How can you run a government when you've got the people who are sucking the greatest and using the resources of this country the most, who are using the court system the most, who are using, you know, to enforce contracts, when they're paying no taxes?
Ryan's budget is scored by CBO by reducing the deficit by 86% by the fifth year, and you're a despicable liar.
All right, I'm a despicable liar.
All right. I'm ashamed of you. I'm ashamed
Peter,
to be on your show.
Peter, if that's the strongest thing you got to say, I will leave you with the last word.
You're not interested in
people can read about it over at thecccp.org. Peter Ferrara. Thank you, Peter.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Amazing election strategy. You, sir, when you tell the facts, you are a despicable liar. It's going to be fascinating to see if it works.
It's just
helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Shirley in Emmitsburg, Iowa. Hey, Shirley, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for all your programs. I'd like to remind people, I'm sure you know this, that Eisenhower, after World War II, came in with our national budget. Our national debt was 120% of GDP.
Right.
And that was when he put in the big transportation system, which
yep.
Obama wants to do now,
yep.
and brought us out of all that.
That's right. Eisenhower, the peak was 127% of GDP after World War II. Harry Truman was president. He got it down by about 7% by growing us out of it. And then Eisenhower came in and borrowed a lot of money and built the national highway system. Not just the national highway system. He built schools all across America. He built hospitals all across America. He sent GIs to college for free and paid them a stipend. My dad was one of them. He helped people buy homes. I mean, and he was a Republican. And you're absolutely right. Excellent point, Shirley. Thank you so much for calling and making it very, very well said. Jeanette in Chicago listening on WCPT. Hey, Jeanette, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for being on our time now. It makes it easy
for
me to call.
I'm very, very pleased now to be live on Chicago's Progressive Talk every single day.
Great. Well, I want to talk about the issue of national security. And I think that healthcare, education, a cleaner environment, and more of a balance between the classes is a detriment to our national security.
You mean not having those things is a detriment to our...
Absolutely,
yeah.
Not yeah. having those things.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, I would say that this whole... The fact that we don't have a national health care system... I mean, look at what happened with SARS. Look at what could... Look in 1918, 1919, the flu epidemic. If there was to be a terrorist biological or chemical weapons attack, or if there was to be an epidemic or a pandemic... Without a national healthcare system, we're in trouble. I mean, this is a national, as you point out, this is a national security issue.
Absolutely. And the woman who just called in who said her local hospital closed, where would people go?
Right.
What would they do?
Right.
It would devastate us. And not educating people so that they can be the doctors, the engineers, the scientists of the world, is another threat to our well-being.
Absolutely. And we are not building our intellectual infrastructure. You are so right, Jeanette, and thank you so much for the call, and thanks for listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk. Jim in Raton, New Mexico. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Well, Tom, President Obama mentioned in his speech social Darwinism.
Yes.
I think it might be very helpful if you explained what that is.
I would be pleased to. When Darwin proposed the his theory of how species evolve over time, his I believe Survival of the Fittest might appear once in Origin of Species. But his cousin, or his nephew, one or the other, Sir Francis Galton, I believe he was his cousin, took this as and coined the phrase social Darwinism and promoted social Darwinism as a way of saying, well, you know, if survival of the fittest is how nature works, then the fittest must be the richest, because obviously you have to get richest, you have to be the fittest, and therefore society should organize itself in a way that continually benefits those who are at the top and disadvantages those at the bottom, because those at the bottom are not as deserving because they're not as fit, and those at the top are more deserving because they're more fit. That's social Darwinism. And social Darwinism is a horrible policy. First of all, it's based on a fallacy that there's some kind of genetic origin to people being fit or unfit. Social Darwinism in the 1800s, the late 1800s, was the theory that was used in the United States, I mean, historically, for centuries, it was used in the United States to justify slavery and then apartheid, and to this day, to justify racism. But even within the so-called white race, social Darwinism, when a lot of Irishmen came over here after the potato famine in 1848, there were two large waves of Irish immigration to the United States in the 1850s and 60s and in the 1870s. And they were poor. They were settling largely in Boston. They were widely discriminated against. People were speculating about the Irish gene. There must be something wrong with them genetically. They're criminals, right? But then eventually they kind of assimilated into society and nobody talks like that anymore. And then in the 1890s, big wave of Italian immigration. And the mafia started popping. Oh, there must be something with the genetic. It is all nonsense. It is social Darwinism is a system that perpetuates itself. It is self-predicting, and all the more the tragedy. I mean, this is just, it's awful. Tim in Long Island, listening on TomHartman.com. Tim, we just have a minute of the break. A quick one?
Yeah, Tom, real big fan, love the show. It just amazes me how few people know about the Star of the Beast mentality that they ushered in 30 years ago and the Paul Ryan budget plan. It's just a culmination of the Solve the Beast plan. But real quickly, I just wanted to mention that you like to talk about how it all started with Reagan. You can make the case that it might have all started with Cheney. Because not a lot of people know that when Art Laffer laid out that ridiculous curve on that cocktail napkin, the first people he showed it to were Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
So it just shows you that.
Who were the aides to Gerald Ford at that
Gerald
time?
Gerald Ford.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, that just shows what Dick Cheney's been doing to this country for the last.
Yeah, Dick Cheney, the guy who just got a heart transplant and who has been so ably cared for by government funded health care all these years. It's pretty amazing.
Real quick, you had talked about just a couple minutes ago about 25-year-old people that could be devastated by a spinal cord injury. I just want to let you know I'm one of them. I have a spinal cord injury at age 18.
Ouch.
And I rely on Medicaid, and it's not a perfect program, but it helps me get by with a lot of things.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for validating that. I appreciate the call. Thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how are the Republicans going to win any elections now? Now that the truth is out about the Paul Ryan budget. Are they just going to lie?
Stand up, stand up. You shall not be moved except by a woman dying from a loss of food. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up and I'll copy you.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception, Tom Hartman here with you. And the president came out this morning and pointed out that even Ronald Reagan couldn't get through a Republican primary now. So true. So the question I have asked, and I am going to continue to ask this, how do the Republicans think that they're going to win elections now that all but 10 of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, a couple hundred Republicans, voted in favor of the Paul Ryan budget that's basically hollows out America, slashes everything except military spending that defends our oil companies bringing oil to the United States. How are they going to do that? Well, here's one clue. They're going to lie. There's a handful of schools in California that don't teach history classes. Why? Because they are medical schools. That's what they are. They're medical schools. That's all they do is they teach medicine. They teach biology. They teach, you know, you go to become an MD. But that little fact somehow got left out when Rick Santorum was on the campaign stump yesterday.
And at the California universities, it's several, I think it's seven or eight of the California system of universities don't even teach an American history course. It's not even available to be taught. Just to tell you how bad it's gotten in this country.
That's how bad it's gotten in this country. That our medical schools don't teach history. They don't teach economics either. They don't teach, they don't teach geography. They don't teach, come on. I mean, they're going to have to lie their way into it. Anyway. D in Park Forest, Illinois. Hey, D, what's up?
What's up? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, D. Good to hear from you.
Yes, as you said, they're going to have to lie, cheat, and steal their way in. Just like the guy that you just interviewed, they seem to have the mindset, whereas we know what the facts are, but we don't give a damn, and we don't want to hear them.
Right.
So whenever we hear them, we're just going to block it out, and we are so indoctrinated with our own ideology and our own mindset and our own little cliques. Like, I've listened to Sean Hannity. I swear to God to you, man, he can tell 10 lies in 30 seconds flat about 10 different subjects. He's very good.
Yeah, he is. Dee, thank you for the call. I'm not going to comment on individual hosts, but the reality is that on the right, well, yeah, this is basically the only option that they have is Dee to change the subject or lie about it. Michelle in Sacramento. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I enjoy your show immensely.
Thank you. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
My main general comment is this. I've worked most of my life. I'm now 58. And I am on the unemployment, which I take great umbrage to the fact that we don't have any jobs to go to.
Mm-hmm.
I have paid into Social Security all my life.
Right.
And the other portion of that payment is my employer. When I've been independently employed, meaning I've got my own butt out the door and did my own job, I paid full price for Social
Security. Right, you paid double.
I paid double. My question is, who the hell do they think they are playing with what we already invested in? That's ours.
Yeah.
They treat it like it's something like, let's just go into the forestry and cut down these trees because they just happen to be there. No, this is an invested part of our community, our United States. It's something that helps us be independent and take care of our futures.
Yeah.
They treat it like it's some kind of a armpit of the body. I don't understand who gives them the right, the toy.
What people have to understand, and Michelle, is that these people are predators. They look at that $2.6 trillion, $2 million billion, $2.6 trillion sitting in the Social Security Trust Fund. And their only thought is how much money they can make off it or how much money their bankster friends can make off it if they hand it off to their bankster friends who will then recycle it back to them as campaign contributions and fancy vacations and huge salaries when they retire from Congress. And this all and what has happened is because our system has been so corrupted by money as a consequence of a series of insane Supreme Court decisions, Congress never passed these laws. No president in history has ever agreed with them. In fact, presidents from George Washington forward have spoken out against them. But because of a series of insane Supreme Court decisions, and by the way, a lot of other countries like Canada and Switzerland, they do not allow their Supreme Court to do these kinds of things, to knock down laws. These insane Supreme Court decisions have corrupted the system, and when you have a corrupted system, it draws corrupted people, corruptible people. And so we have this sociopathy going on in our political system. Michelle, thank you for your call, and thanks for pointing it out. Bill in Longview, Washington. Hey, Bill, thanks for listening to KPOJ. What's up?
I'd just like to explain a little more about how the debit card works for Social Security.
They've already implemented it?
Oh, yeah. I've been on it for a couple of years.
Oh, okay.
And
Give us a quick thumbnail then, please. I'm sorry. I don't have any personal knowledge of this. So.
Okay. I've got a MasterCard.
Uh-huh.
MasterCard. Every month, they deposit the Social Security money into that account. I don't know how much the government pays for it. There are no fees for it.
Okay.
To the recipient.
Right.
And it costs you nothing to get the money out.
Right.
If you go to major corporations who they will accept the card as payment, and you usually can get cash back up to $200.
Yeah. So it's not a bad deal, and it's probably not costing the government much more than the postage would have, plus all the losses associated with people stealing things out of the mail. As much as I want the post office to carry more things through the mail so that they can keep on going, so you think
it's reliable. It's reliable and convenient.
Okay. Okay, good. Thanks a lot for that, Bill. I appreciate it. Olajuwon in Newark, listening to WWRL. Am I mispronouncing your name?
No, yeah, it's Olajuwon.
Olajuwon. Hey, how you doing?
Yes.
What's up?
Hey, I thought I'd comment about the Paul Ryan budget.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is going to slash the big three. I wish President Obama would continue to hammer hard and connect Mitt Romney to Paul Ryan and the Republicans together. Because if the Republicans think they're gonna run with this and win, then to the Democrats, we don't need the House or the Senate anymore.
No, I think you're right, Olajuwon. And as I said, the only way that the Republicans can run on this and win is to lie. And get ready, because there's $500 million, it's probably $1 billion. Worth outside money coming in against President Obama coming up in this election. Stephen in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Stephen, what's up? Stephen? Oh, I'm sorry. Dave in Fort Collins, Colorado. I pushed the wrong button. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I would like, if we're not too far off theme here, to talk about Simpson Bowles a little bit.
Sure.
When this was first laid out, I got to admit I was fairly ambivalent about it. I think it was kind of the progress of the negotiations at the time, the mood of the times, I don't know, but as I look back on it, now in hindsight, it looks like it was probably pretty attractive.
Well, there was no it is one of the big problems, and nobody's acknowledging this. The Simpson-Bowles Commission had 12 members. They had to have a supermajority. I believe it might have been unanimous, but it had to either be a supermajority or a unanimous in order to pass. And Jan Schakowsky's come on this program and explained this. She was a member of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, the congresswoman from the from Northern Illinois, from the Chicago area. And she and a number of other progressives on the Simpson-Bowles Commission said, no, we're not going to go along with cuts to Social Security. And so there was never an official finding. As a result of that, Mr. Simpson and Mr. Bowles got together, and they wrote up their own little suggestion, and they said, okay, here's our suggestion, which is what the president was referring to today. But the Simpson-Bowles Commission, or committee, whichever it was, never actually released an official finding.
I see. Well, so do you think it's possible that we may be able to get back to something very close to that?
I don't know, and I'm not even sure that it's desirable. I agree with Jan Schakowsky. There are ways. Simpson-Bowles was unwilling to raise taxes substantially on wealthy people, unwilling to raise corporate taxes, unwilling to even consider the possibility of tariffs on imported goods. They were unwilling to deal with the real structural things that need to be done. And so I think it was just a very, very flawed commission. There were a couple of progressives on there like Jan Schakowsky, and then there was a bunch of conservatives, and then there was, half of them were Republicans, which ranged from crazy to extremely crazy. And I'm just not a fan of Simpson-Bowles. I don't think that, although the president is trying to speak well of them because it was viewed as a bipartisan kind of moderate effort, frankly, it was to the right of Dwight Eisenhower. And I wouldn't want to go back to it. I wouldn't want to reconsider it. It was a plan to cut America and not to take us back to the kind of prosperity that we had in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s before Reagan came in and dropped that top tax rate from 74% down to 28%. Now you've got people like Mitt Romney paying a maximum 15% income tax on millions and millions of dollars a year in income. This is the president has now come out and said, you know, the Buffett rule, thank you for the call, by the way, has said the Buffett rule is basically a repudiation of Simpson-Bowles. He's saying if you earn, and he said this in his speech today, if you earn over $1 million, not if you have $1 million. So a lot of people have a net worth of $1 million and they're not really rich. They just have a house, you know, in you know, San Francisco or something. But if you're earning over $1 million a year, then after that first million, you start paying taxes at the same rate the average American does.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the Republicans are like, where's my fainting couch? I can't handle this. I'm all, you know, it's incredible. The same taxes as average Americans?
Show me what it's like.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, the place where despair is not an option. Ellen Ratner on the, well, not on the line. She's sitting right next to me here. Ellen, you were at the White House.
Well,
today.
We had pool today, which means that Jeff was actually in the motorcade on his way to the speech, and I was recording the speech. You sort of need a two deal if you're on pool because one of us is busy following the president. So I offered to stay back and sit at the White House and listen to the speech.
So you watched the speech with a bunch of people who are White House correspondents
I
and
did.
White House staffers,
yeah.
And how did they respond?
Well, the staffers weren't there, but we were all, I mean, those of us who are sort of more on the Democratic side, a lot of people were gone today because and when there isn't a press conference or press briefing, people just kind of, it's like they're not around. But the ones that were there were like, wow, this guy has just come back. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is the Obama I knew and loved.
Yeah, in 2008.
That's right. The 2008 Obama is here. And I was completely amazed by it.
Yeah, it was a very impressive speech. And I think that one of the most important things was, this is the first president since Ronald Reagan to call out Reaganomics.
That's right. And he was very clear about Reaganomics. He basically said, listen, you know, they've attacked this plan. And Ronald Reagan did not put forth, he did not deal. One of my hosts said to me, well, what did he say about the deficit? I said, well, he said a lot about the deficit. He said, Ronald Reagan increased taxes many times in order to reduce the deficit.
Right.
And nobody's talking about that.
Yeah, well, the Democrats have on occasion, but you're
well,
right.
Well, no, but I mean, it's not like you don't see it in the press. You don't see the Republicans talk about that.
No. Well,
now, also, it's interesting today. The president was speaking at the Associated Press. Well, it's actually the Society of Newspapers Editors, and Associated Press was sort of doing the luncheon.
That's here in D.C.
Yes, and Christine Lagarde, I can never pronounce her name, from the International Monetary Fund from France, also spoke today, and she said, "Listen, yes, the economy, the world economy." Economy is coming back, but it is going to be a fragile comeback. And she warned against governments cutting down on government spending as
really?
A way. Yes, she did.
The head of the IMF came out against austerity?
Yes, she did.
She came out against Paul Ryan?
Well, pretty much she did. Yes, she did. It
amazing.
Was quite shocking.
Yeah. Especially given that the IMF has been kind of buying into neoliberalism over the last decade or
well, not two. Her, boy.
Yeah.
I mean, and actually, if you, what was that movie? There was a movie, it was around the last election, and it was all about spending. It was sort of one of those election lefty movies or whatever, and they have her in it. And you've seen the movie, I'm just blocking on
the documentary?
Yeah, it was one of those, it was like a Michael Moore one, but it was done by somebody else.
Right.
Maybe it was Michael Moore's one on money.
Yeah.
And she's all over it, and she's like, I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
I was hoping she'd be president of France, but having her at IMF isn't too bad.
Well, it was interesting to hear the president shout out to her. You know, he said, you know, Christine Lagarde, or however you say it, Lagarde, is here in the audience, the head of the IMF, and I think she will agree with me.
Right.
And you didn't
well,
hear
she
her
did,
yell,
and she spoke
wow.
before the president today.
Interesting.
So that was kind of interesting. So, okay, I call it the fire and brimstone on the Democratic side. Your friend, Dick Cheney, was released from the hospital today. He's 71 years old after a heart transplant.
Government funded, wasn't it? Yeah. He's gotten good government health care all these years.
He certainly has. He certainly has. It's quite astounding, yeah. Isn't it? A lot of international news today. North Korea, Secretary Panetta from Defense actually spoke to his counterpart in Japan. They talked a lot about North Korea. And, of course, North Korea is talking about this, you know, missile that they're going to make that's going to go, it's going to... it can go directly to the United States. Of course, they said that that violates their obligations. At the Pentagon briefing, that came up, but the Pentagon, again, didn't want to talk about it, so nobody really wants to talk about it. All the Pentagon would say is that Panetta and his counterpart in Japan had this conversation. The Pakistan State Department announced $12 million reward for a particular group of two leaders that they said included the bombings in Mumbai. And the State Department also said today via Susan Rice at the United Nations, the United States is giving $25 million to the Syrian opposition for humanitarian and non-lethal aid. Russia said Syria is going to cooperate, and the government of Syria, yeah. And Susan Rice said she doubts it.
Yeah,
so,
I doubt it, too.
Yeah. South Sudan, another international issue today, and the president said $26 million from emergency refugee and migration assistance going on there because of what's going on in South Kordofan, of course. And they will not allow international observers or aid in that area.
Who's the they that won't allow it?
Sudan, North Sudan.
North Sudan.
Yeah.
So Khartoum is threatening to blow up if they go in, which is Mr. Bashir, the accused war criminal.
That's right. I just got to tell you, I mean, just back to the president's speech, the reporters were, people I talked to were kind of dumbfounded.
How do you respond... Or how do you think the reporters would respond in general, the press corps, to the assertion? I've heard two negative assertions about the president's speech. One, of course, came from Paul Ryan, who basically said the president's just trying to divide America. But he didn't dispute any of the facts.
Facts to dispute.
Well, you know, the president laid out all these things that Ryan's budget will do, and Ryan didn't say any of that was not truthful. But then the other argument is that, well, he's just saying, you know, he's catering to the base. He's saying the things that will get him elected. And don't plan on his running the White House that way for the next 4 years. I look back at the campaign that he ran in 2008, and he talked about fundamental change, but he didn't get into the specifics. And
he can get into the specifics because he's got them.
Right. And he's president. And it seems to me, and plus he'll be a lame duck president, which means that he doesn't have to worry about running for reelection. It seems to me that the probabilities are radically higher that he's going to move in the direction of FDR rather than, you know.
I think there's not even a question about that. And I think today's speech, because he's going to be asked just the question you've asked during the debates. Well, Mr. President, you came in 2008. You said this. You kind of, throttled back a bit. And now you're saying this again. What is to make the American people believe it? I mean, I can just hear them framing the question that way. And I think he is going to say, you know, we tried to negotiate. We tried it their way. It didn't work. It hasn't worked. We're going to do it, you know, my way kind of thing.
Right. Amazing. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st. Up next, Van Jones, How Can Americans Rebuild the Dream?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, and the co-founder of the Rebuild the Dream. What do you call that, Ben?
It's an organization.
Organization. Okay, thank you very much. A former White House advisor to President Obama, the author of a new book, The Rebuild the Dream. Oddly enough named. RebuildTheDream.com, the website. Van Jones on the line with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be here, sir.
Great to have you with us. So, first of all, how do we rebuild the dream, and how do the policy prescriptions in your book comport with some of the suggestions that the president was making in this brilliant speech today?
Well, you know, I think everybody's moving in the right direction. I wrote this book because I think I have a unique point of view as a grassroots outsider who became a White House insider and then became a grassroots outsider again.
I have kind of a 360-degree view of where we got off track with this movement for hope and change that we had really started building in 2003 when Bush invaded Iraq. That was really when the first time you saw, you know, multiracial people of all genders and ages coming out of the houses, you know, by the millions protesting that war. Mm-hmm. No one great leader, just a great movement that we were building, and all through the Howard Dean phase and the Al Gore climate phase and getting Pelosi into the speaker's chair, all of that work, and Katrina and the heartbreak of that, all of that work led to the opportunity for Obama to run, win. And I try to capture that history in the book so we don't forget that it wasn't just Obama's greatness, it was also our greatness that made that breakthrough possible. But I also remember going from hope to heartbreak, like so many of us did, and I wanted to make sense of it. How could we go from that mountaintop to that valley so quickly? And the book really tries to get that history right and therefore put us in a position where we can start fighting once again for the change that we believe in and need.
Okay, so I'm assuming that the hope is the election of President Obama in 2008 and the heartbreak is the inability of the Obama administration to produce. I mean, he said he was going to fundamentally change America. To produce that fundamental change, given in my scenario, given people like Ben Nelson in the Senate, but I'm curious your take on and is that the heartbreak that you're talking about, or is it something else?
Well, sure. The heartbreak is we weren't able to deal with many of the issues that we'd hoped to, from climate change. Having gotten the House of Representatives to actually pass a bill, the Senate never even took a vote to keep us from burning the planet, you know, or melting the planet down, all the way to the rise of the Tea Party and the loss of the speakership of Nancy Pelosi in the House in 2010. And so, which is not to say that the president didn't achieve a lot, and it's just the hole is so deep that it turned out that just having some of the mechanisms of government power, what we thought was 100% of what we needed, because we had the House, the Senate, and the White House, it turned out that was one-third of what we needed. We also needed a media operation as sophisticated and aggressive as what Fox and those guys had put up, and we needed a movement of people in the streets to counter the Tea Party. The fact that we had not prioritized having that media capacity to talk to the people on a daily basis, not just during the campaign, and the fact that we did not have a grassroots counter opposition in the streets, peacefully, nonviolently. In most countries, when the right wing starts to march, the left wing starts to march. Mm-hmm. And in this country, for whatever reason, we let the right wing have a monopoly on almost all protest activity with those Tea Party protests for 2 years. It had a terrible effect.
Right.
On the mentality of everybody in Washington, D.C., the White House included.
Well, you know, there's a fundamental reality behind that, and I'm sure you're aware of it. I know you're aware of it, Van Jones, and that is that, first of all, the Tea Party was being largely funded in the background by the Koch brothers. Those $350,000 well-painted buses don't appear out of nowhere. Those you know, $175,000 a day or an hour rental sound stages don't just drop out of the sky. Those permits for big parks and big gigs and things like, you know, there was a lot of money that went into this. The two big PR firms in Los Angeles and New York that were paid millions of dollars. Dick Armey, a multimillionaire, and one of the largest lobbyists on K Street here in D.C., funding, you know, Americans for Prosperity, and, you know, them promoting the Tea Party. So you had that, and you had the fact that Rupert Murdoch had lost $500 million. He lost $100 million a year for 5 years. Sean Hannity, you know, they say Air America failed, right, because it lost $14 million over the period of 6 years. Fox News lost $500 million, $500 million, before they made their first penny. But he was willing to spend $500 million to get to the point where they made their first penny and build that right-wing infrastructure. Nobody has done that on the left, to the best of my knowledge.
This is true. And what we have to recognize, though, is that those facts are available, and yet we acted as if we did not know that.
Yeah. You mean the White House did?
And not just the White House, also a big part of the progressive left. You saw the progressive left split into, diehard fans of Obama. Obama could do no wrong. Or disappointed fans. Wow, this second album sucks. And, let's just blog about it and complain about it. And somewhere between, hoping too much and moping too much, we forgot to build that fight back and that runs down the middle and says we're going to walk with this White House when we can, far ahead of it when we can't, and march against it when we have to.
Yeah.
And that lack of a independent movement, I say in the book, LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, did not lead the civil rights movement. That was not his job. He was the head of state. Obama's the head of state. There had to be an independent movement led by Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Bayard Rustin, Martin Luther King, in the streets to make him and to create the opportunity for him to do the great things that he did as a president. A great president is a function of a great movement, not the other way around.
Right.
And so the book, I'm the first Obama official, former Obama official, to write a book. It came out today. It's available online at Powell's and Amazon and all the places that you can buy books online. It's available in ebook form as well. The point of the book is that the movement for hope and change did not start with Obama. It started well before he ever ran, and it cannot end just because he is in the White House. We have to continue to build a movement focused on economic solutions for the vast majority. Now, luckily, the president is beginning to move in a more progressive, populist direction on the economy. But here's what I want your listeners to be aware of. There are two fights this year, not one. One fight comes to an end in November, which is around the election. But the second fight starts in December. The lame duck Congress that will be meeting about the Bush tax cuts, that even while we're celebrating in the streets Obama's victory, we could still be stabbed through the rib cage while our hands are over our head on the key question, which is who is going to pay to clean up the mess that the financial elites made of our country? Is it going to be the 99%, the working people, the middle class people, the poor? Or will the people who enjoyed the party, who had the party, have to pay to clean up their own mess, and the 1% have to finally pony up? And that fight happens in December, not November, in December. And if we do not have a conscious movement that is clear that we have to reelect this president, at the same time we re-energize an independent movement, we will have a victory in November and a colossal defeat in December.
Yeah, given that the Tea Party runs the House of Representatives, and they will not have gone away in December. They're going to be running that show. Amazing. Van Jones, his new book, Rebuild the Dream, the website rebuildthedream.com. The book just out today. Check it out at your favorite bookseller of choice. And Van Jones, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Thank you very much.
Always great having you on the program. We will be back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program, 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How would you rebuild the dream if you were in charge? Or for that matter, what is the American dream these days? That'll be my thoughts right after this.
Out here the nights are long, the days are lonely. I think of you, I'm working on a dream. I'm working on a dream.
Oh, perfect song to follow Van Jones and his new book, Rebuild the Dream. Virginia, and oh, by the way, Virginia, hold on just a second. I wanted to be sure that our listeners to We Act Radio, the radio station that we're on live here in Washington, D.C., knew about this, that Drinking Liberally is tonight here in D.C. Check the Drinking Liberally national website for the one near you, because they're all over the country. But the one here in D.C. is tonight at Lounge 201, which is on Mass Avenue Northeast near Union Station, and it's at 6 p.m. It's the first and third Tuesday of the month, and if you want to meet Jacob Dean, our associate producer, he will be there. And so, anyhow, Virginia, what's on your mind today? Thanks for calling from Portland.
Tom Hartman, Portland, Oregon, loves you.
Well, thank you. I love Portland, Oregon. I still own a floating home there.
I know you do. Listen, I've been puzzling about this for the longest time, and I just wanted your reaction. My sense is what the Confederacy could not win on the field at Gettysburg, they are now attempting to seize in the Supreme Court and the halls of Congress. It's the same mindset. Hate the federal government, dismantle the federal government, states' rights forever, let us do what we want to do. And I think we need to call them out for what they are.
Yeah, except that
I think we need to defend the union.
Except that I don't think, you know, it's sort of like the caller earlier who wanted to make a Hitler analogy. I really don't, you know, with the exception of a few fringe folks, I really don't think that there are very many of these hardcore Republicans who are calling for return to slavery.
No, I don't think they go that far. I think they recognize that's not acceptable. But to keep the entire working class, white and black, females and men alike, in a state of subservience so they can be exploited is only one step up, and that's where they want to be.
Right. Okay. I get your argument.
That's where they want to be.
Yeah.
And I know people down south. I talk to them, and, they look around and scratch their heads and go like, oh, my God, this place has not changed in 200 years. And if you're outside of a few big metropolitan areas like Atlanta, it's true.
Yeah, we lived in Atlanta for several decades and almost 15 years or thereabouts, and I get it, Virginia. Virginia, thank you very much for the call. I think we need to be careful of hyperbole. On the other hand, there is this movement that is absolutely bizarre in the United States. Tim in Manor, Texas. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to know whose exact responsibility is it to impeach members of the judiciary when they screw things up?
The House of Representatives.
Uh-huh.
It's right there
and,
in the Constitution.
How do we encourage the House of Representatives to do their job?
You know, you call your member of the House of Representatives and you say, you guys have two responsibilities or rights with regard to the Supreme Court. The first is the Supreme Court has to operate under regulations defined by Congress. So you can pass a law saying that the Supreme Court justices must comply with the federal judicial code of conduct, number one, or any other regulations that Congress wants to make. You know, you can do that. Congress can do that. And, for example, they could expand the number of members of the Supreme Court to 11, or they could pass a law and say that, like in Switzerland, if the Supreme Court is going to make a ruling, it has to be a super majority. It has to be 2/3, not just 5-4. You have to have, you know, what would that be? 7-2, I guess, would be a super majority, or maybe 6-3. But anyhow, Congress can actually establish those rules. And secondly, you have the right to impeach these guys for the crimes that they have committed, which include the false testimony that Alito and Thomas gave before Congress during their hearings to bring them in, you know, to install them on the Supreme Court, and secondly, for the behavior that they've engaged in, which is, you know, would be illegal for any other federal judge, not to mention, you know, their vast overreaching. I mean, it's funny because I remember when Daddy Koch, Fred Koch, was alive and running the John Birch Society or funding it or whatever he was doing with it. And they had these signs all across America that said impeach Earl Warren, because they felt that in 1954 with Brown versus Board of Education integrating the schools, that he had gone a mile too far. He was legislating from the bench. Activist judges. You talk about activist judges. Boy, do we have them now. I mean, it's just incredible. So anyhow, thanks a lot for the call, Tim. Good to hear from you. Dottie in Plattsburgh, New York. Hey, Dottie, what's on your mind today?
Well, I want to get back to the health care issue and the Paul Ryan's plan with Medicare and Mitt Romney in Massachusetts Mass Health. Mr. Romney thinks it's a state issue. The Ryan plan would put a lot of things back to the states, but the states are broke.
Yeah. No, nobody told Paul Ryan that, apparently.
And I have to ask this about Mr. Romney. If we're all Americans and he thought this was good enough for the citizens of Massachusetts and gets to be president, which I doubt, why wouldn't he expand it to cover all Americans? Why is he so against this?
Well, you know, Paul Ryan is a multimillionaire and Mitt Romney is a multimillionaire.
Yes.
I don't know the circumstances of Paul Ryan's birth, but I know that right now his federal filing forms show that he's a multimillionaire. Mitt Romney was born a multimillionaire and has never in his life, you know, he's never in his life had the experience of, I mean, he said, I worried about getting a pink slip, but he doesn't really know what that means.
And that's the other thing, Tom, that I wanted to mention. When they're talking about taxes and reducing taxes and taxes are too high, Mitt Romney's father, George, made all of his money when the tax rate was between 91 and 72 for the top earners,
yep.
And he's a great beneficiary of it. How can you say taxes thwart wealth or wealth creation when that's exactly the time and the period of high taxes that his father became a multimillionaire and left it to Mitt?
Well, and here's another interesting thing, is that when his father was running American Motors, AMC, in Michigan before he was governor, he was offered a huge bonus, and I don't recall if it was when he left office or what it was, but there was one particular year he was offered a huge bonus, and he turned it down because he said it wouldn't be fair. That was George Romney, Mitt's dad. So I think the apple fell a long way from the tree. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Dottie, thank you for the call. George Romney was a reasonably good governor. I lived in Michigan back then.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Mitt, on the other hand, not so much. Coming up next, the good, the bad, and the very, very new vocabulary word ugly. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very papilliferously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good. Maine Senator Olympia Snow. Snow, a moderate Republican, attacked her party last night for using contraception as part of the political debate in America today. She told a crowd at a Women's Campaign Fund gala that, "I feel like it's a retro debate that took place in the 1950s. It is surprising in the 21st century we would be revisiting this issue." Seems Snow realizes there are more important debates to be having today, like how to rebuild our economy or protect our environment. The sudden debate over contraception in America is nothing more than political grandstanding by Republicans. Hopefully Senator Snow can convince some of her colleagues to jump off the bandwagon and focus on what really matters. The bad. Mitt Romney. Yesterday, Romney became the latest conservative to bash the Chevy Volt, General Motors' super fuel-efficient hybrid vehicle and Big Oil's worst nightmare. Speaking in Wisconsin, he told a crowd, "I'm not sure America was ready for the Chevy Volt, but I think instead of having politicians tell us what kind of cars we ought to make, we ought to let the people who are trying to understand the market make that decision." Not all that surprising, coming from a man who hates Detroit and would love to see the American automobile industry disappear. And the very, very ugly Detroit's Frederick Douglass Academy. 50 students were suspended from the all-boys school last Thursday after walking out of class in protest. Students were demanding a proper education and complaining about a lack of consistent teachers and a shortage of textbooks, among other things. One student told a local newspaper that, "We've been wronged and disrespected and lied to and cheated." Detroit has been designated ground zero for education reform by Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. And education isn't just a problem in Detroit, it's a problem across this country. Our public education system is broken and needs to be fixed. Punishing those who are trying to address the problem and promote change? Now that is very, very ugly. That's really very, very ugly. That's remarkably very ugly. Oh, man. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Frank in Ladora, Iowa. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind?
Not much. I was listening to your show. I like your show. And you had a question about how the Republicans are going to win this year.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that they was going to lie. Well, I got two other things they're going to do. One is the voter ID that most of the governors are trying to put in.
You're right. Throw 5 million people off the voting rolls.
Yep. I heard one state dropped it. And so they're going to be using that. And the other one is they got an ace in the back pocket, which is the Supreme Court.
Oh, in another Bush v. Gore, is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, I'm hoping it won't come to that, but...
Yeah,
you know
what's bizarre is that the Constitution actually provides for a tied presidential election, and it throws it to the House of Representatives. And they then choose who's the president. But Bush v. Gore was like such a crime by the Supreme Court. I mean, just such a crime. It's unspeakable what a crime it was. But, yeah, they've got the Supreme Court in their pocket. Good point, Frank. Thanks very much for the call. Tom in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Tom, what's up?
You know, thinking about what Dan Jones is saying about needing a movement to counteract the Tea Party, as you point out, the Tea Party is AstroTurf. And I'm always struck when I see poll results. It seems to me that the American public in polls support progressive policies like 60% or 70%.
Yes.
And I remember in Obama's first 2 years in office, you and other progressives urged him to be more like FDR and to appeal to the discontent in the populace and that and those people that support progressive policies. And it didn't happen.
Right.
So I'm wondering how you can be sure that he's going to do again and to do it in his second term.
Well, I'm not, but I am hopeful. And I also believe that, I mean, when he was running for president, he was speaking in vague generalities, by and large. Hope and change are not specific policy things. And as a consequence of that, he became a national Rorschach test. People on the right heard him talk about hope and change, and they thought that he was going to turn America into some socialist, god-awful thing, right? He was going to turn us into the Soviet Union or East Berlin. And people on the left heard him say that, and they thought, oh, he's going to give us instant single-payer health care and, raise the top tax rate back to 74% or 91% where it was during the time of America's greatest prosperity. The fact of the matter is he didn't have a Congress that would have allowed him to do either. I mean, he couldn't have turned us into the Soviet Union, and he couldn't have turned us into America under FDR or under Dwight Eisenhower. So, you know, instead, what we got was what we got. But the fact of the matter is that if we show up, if enough of us mobilize, and Van Jones is absolutely right about this, you have to have a movement. You know, go to Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, sign up. You can start your own local chapter wherever you live. Go to Jim Dean's organization, democracyforamerica.com. I saw Jim Dean last night. Last night I did the introduction here in Washington, D.C. for Robert Greenwald's new movie on the Koch brothers. And Jim Dean was there, and Robert Borsage and Robert Greenwald and others. And it was great. And it was a lot of good grassroots activists showed up. That's what it's going to take. It's like the question, Tom, that you're asking almost implies that we think that our president is a king or that we think that our president is the one who makes policy. The president doesn't make policy. The president follows policy. The president may propose policies, but as Van Jones pointed out, Lyndon Johnson wasn't the leader of the civil rights movement. He signed the legislation. The legislation had to be passed by Congress. Who put those people into Congress? The voters. It was who brought this to the fore? The civil rights movement. It wasn't the Lyndon Johnson movement. And it's not going to be the Barack Obama movement that brings about positive change in America. He's not standing up right now and speaking out the way he did because he's leading it. He's following it. That's what politicians do. The word leader does not appear in the Constitution. And in fact, this morning I downloaded the entire Federalist Papers, and I was going through looking for the word leader and leadership in the Federalist Papers. And the word leadership doesn't appear anywhere in the Federalist Papers. And the word leader appears a couple of times, but they're talking about, you know, we rejected the leader of England and that kind of thing. I mean, it's the whole concept, and Tom, thank you for the call, the whole concept that we should be turning to our president and saying, please save us, is not the way American democracy works. The president follows us. Which means that we have to get out in the streets. We have to be speaking up. We have to be the ones who are shouting out. We need to say this is what we want. And it's now is the time. If not now, when? If not us, who? AJ in Belmont, Wisconsin. Hey AJ, what's up?
Hey Tom, thanks for taking my call. Love your show. Two things. I got a pitch for you, and then lastly, I'd like to talk about the Supreme Court. The pitch is, as much as I think free speech TV is a breath of fresh air away from Fox so-called news and CNN and the like, the unfortunate truth is with media of any kind, the majority of the people that listen to any such media would be people that agree with it and follow it. Obviously Fox News is conservative and CNN would be the liberal side. I
think not. First of all, CNN, I think, is mostly, at least it used to be, and I would that it was again, people who would just want news. Fox News, I'm amazed continuously traveling around this country, the number of restaurants that I walk into, bars I walk into, hotels I walk into, particularly in the Midwest, where Fox News is on. because, you know, they've got this small band of cult followers, basically, but they demand that it be put on in public places. So I think you'd be surprised how many people don't identify themselves as conservatives and watch Fox News, tragically. And the same thing with Free Speech TV. I know, you know, we get a lot of people watching Free Speech TV, and I'm guessing the same thing is probably true of Current and MSNBC, who are not progressives, who are not liberals, who are going, what's going on here? Oh, this is interesting. You know, what do they have to say? So I disagree with your premise. Phil in Tampa. Hey, Phil, thanks for watching Free Speech TV, speaking of.
Okay, I'm listening online. Here's my issue. I've worked for every Democrat since McGovern.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue, I'm going to be candid with you. I'm not real pleased with Obama, and I'll tell you why. First of all, I think he has hired people to work for him who basically, I don't think, have learned how to get the door unlocked and the lights turned on.
Phil, with regard to his economic team and some of the other things in the first year or so of his administration, I wouldn't totally disagree. I don't think Larry Summers should have been in the White House. But that said, have you shown up at a local Democratic Party meeting to do something about it?
I'm going to tell you that I have gotten invitations, and all they want is more money. And I'm going to tell you,
you can show up for free. You can show up for free. Rodney in Chicago Heights, Illinois. Rodney, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Yeah, let me take you off speaker. You and Ellen touched on it, you know, as far as Obama becoming a progressive, and that was my question. But, you know, the head of the IMF, the Korean-American gentleman that he appointed, I was pretty impressed with that. But
This is the World Bank, though, not the IMF. But, yeah, you're right. That was a very impressive appointment.
And I'm living on borrowed time. I'm a union laborer, have been for the last 27 years, and the only way I'm making it now is I'm drawing my pension for the last year, and I had to give up 25.5% off the top.
Yikes.
Because of my age. But,
Rodney, you just vanished. Hang in there. In any case, Rodney, hang in there, and I wish you well. This is the problem, is that the manufacturing middle class, the working class of America, has been ripped apart by Reaganomics. Time to put it back together.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Is there, now that the Ryan budget is out there, the Republicans are on record, everybody can see clearly what it is. Is there any way Republicans can win other than lying?
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Josh Earnest is on the line with us. He's the principal deputy press secretary to the White House press office, whitehouse.gov, of course, the website. Josh, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
Great. Great to have you with us. In the first hour of our program, played a whole mess of clips from this speech today. A lot of progressives are very fired up. There are some who are a little skeptical. How is the White House positioning this really tough talk by the president about a budget that is not that different than the one that Paul Ryan and all the Republicans passed a year ago?
Well, you know, I think you referred to some of your listeners being fired up. I think the president himself was fired up today. Mm-hmm. What you had was the president basically using the opportunity of a ballroom full of journalists from all across the country, and he used this as an opportunity to make it clear that he has a fundamental difference of opinion with the Republican Party and the budget that they've laid out. Now, this is not the fringes of the right wing who've laid out a budget. This is the Republican establishment,
right,
who've basically said that even at this make or break moment for the middle class, even when times are tough and we have a fundamental decision before us about whether we are going to strengthen our economy and deal with our deficit challenges in a way that reinforces what has always been the strength of this country, which is the middle class, or are we going to double down on the policies that got us into this financial mess in the first place, which is to, which is to basically give tax cuts to those at the very top of the income spectrum and leave the rest of us in the middle class and seniors with the tab?
Yeah, yeah. The president talked about, you know, we don't, people like me, he said, his phrase, don't need tax cuts. And I wince a little bit because I think most people don't think of him as a rich guy. They think of him, you know, they know that when he was in the Senate, he was still paying off his student loans. I mean, he made made a couple million bucks selling some best-selling books, but that's kind of an anomaly. If I was advising him, I would tell him to stop playing the role of the rich guy. But his point, I think, is well taken the Buffett rule that people, and this is just people taking home over $1 million a year, and it might be useful to break that down to what that would be in terms of a weekly paycheck.
Right.
And I can't do math in my head that fast.
Neither can I.
That the Buffett rule is like just common sense. This is next, right? You guys are going to bring this.
Yeah, this is what's next. I mean, I think that it's that the Senate 2 weeks from today is scheduled to vote on a Buffett rule proposal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this is something that the president articulated, I guess last summer was when he first sort of rolled out this idea, which is, you know, a very basic sort of idea that's sort of structured around the idea of fairness, which is that we should not be in a situation in which we have people who are making $1 million a year paying a smaller percentage of their income in taxes than middle-class families.
Right. Mitt Romney would be hit by this. Last year he made, what, $13, $14 million? He's paying 14.5% income tax?
And the truth thereabouts. This is the thing that I think important for people to understand. This isn't a character attack against Mitt Romney, right? He's just following the rules, we all assume. The fact is that the rules are broken, right? We have a system that doesn't work. If we have middle-class families who are paying a higher percentage of their hard-earned income in taxes, then somebody who, let's be honest, could be doing a little bit more to pay their fair share when you're talking about millionaires out there who are...
Well, that's because the millionaires can afford the lobbyists who write the laws. And you know, I think what most Americans are looking for is somebody, and this is essentially what the president said he was going to be and do today, and I think in many ways he has up to this point as well, from the Lilly Ledbetter Act to the Affordable Care Act to others, to say, I'm going to be your lobbyist. I'm going to stand for you, the middle class. And move in more of a Franklin Delano Roosevelt direction.
Yeah, and at the end, what this underscores, and this is something that I think was really important, I think this is a lot of what animated the president's view in terms of why he wanted to deliver the speech today, is this represents a fundamental difference of opinion about the way forward. What Republicans suggest is that the way to strengthen our economy, the way to pay down our debt, that what we should do is we should try to maximize the benefits of people at the top of the income scale, that if we reward the wealthy with significant tax breaks, if we reward large corporations with significant tax breaks, if we give them a little bit of a pass, that they will amass a greater fortune and then they'll share that with everybody else. The president has a fundamentally different view about what we should do moving forward. The president believes that what we should do is we should have in place a system that ensures that people who work hard and play by the rules can still have a shot at the American promise of buying a house, paying their mortgage, sending their kids to college, and saving for retirement. That basic covenant with the American people makes our country stronger. That if we have a strong, thriving middle class, that's what makes our country strong. And that's just a fundamental difference of opinion with what, not just what the fringe in the Republican Party are advocating, but what the vast majority of the Republican establishment is saying should be the way forward. And the irony of this is this flies in the face of a lot of the proposals that were advocated by other Republican presidents. You know, when we had this debate over the summer about the benefits of the Buffett rule, there's somebody out there pulled out this footage of President Reagan giving a speech out on the campaign trail saying, does it make sense that we have bus drivers who are paying more in taxes, a greater share of their income in taxes than millionaires?
Right. We've played that on this show many times.
Yeah, you have President Reagan doing a call and response with the crowd saying, no, that's not fair.
Right.
So what the president
actually said, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
But what the president's advocating is a very middle of the road, you know, very moderate position that, frankly, Democrats and Republicans should be able to agree on. You know, people sort of lament that there's so much arguing and backbiting in Washington, D.C. Well, when you have Democrats like the president who are willing to try to find common ground and live up to our broader American values and only is attacked by Republicans on the other side,
it's wrong. It's just wrong.
It makes things a lot difficult.
Josh Earnest, whitehouse.gov. You can check it out. Thanks, Josh.
All right. Thanks for the time.
Good talking with you. And coming up tomorrow, we're going to wrap up today's primary results, plus Jamie Weinstein of the Daily Caller is going to be here. Why do conservatives want mandatory drug tests for anyone receiving government assistance? And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.